You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why piping plovers, a tiny endangered shorebird that can be found by Wisconsin lakes, may make a comeback this year. Now, 49% of Wisconsinites have gotten at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. Almost 45% are fully vaccinated. But vaccination rates from one county to another can differ quite a bit. The state's reporting its lowest seven-day average of new COVID cases in about a year. And this week, the Department of Health Services started reducing hours at six community vaccination clinics around the state. We're talking with an epidemiologist now about what it all means for the months ahead. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what we could safely do, what we should still be concerned about? Have you gotten back to an old normal, a new version of normal? What precautions are you still taking? If someone in your household hasn't been able to get vaccinated yet, are you worried about them contracting COVID-19, especially one of the variants that are out there? And if you've worked in helping people get vaccinated, what has that experience been like for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ajay Sethi is an associate professor of population health sciences and director of the Master of Public Health program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's an infectious disease epidemiologist. Ajay, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start out by looking at the numbers of new cases here in the state. And there have been times we talked to you in the past where this was really bad news back early this year, late last year. Seems like things are looking pretty good now. What are we seeing as you look at the data?
Yeah, they are low. The seven-day average is under 100 at 90 cases. And as you said earlier, we haven't seen numbers that low since March of last year. So that's good news. When I look at the vaccination rates, they certainly are suboptimal. When we have 44% of Wisconsinites fully vaccinated, which is the national average, we could do better, and it would be nice to do that soon.
And this is, we're past the time where there was a supply problem, where, you know, we were vaccinating people as fast as we could, given the supply on hand. Now we've got the vaccines. What do you think it's going to take to get more people vaccinated?
You know, it's going to take a little bit more creativity and a little bit more sort of reaching out to individuals and find out what prevents them from getting vaccinated now. If it's an issue of convenience, we can address that fairly easily. If it's an issue of sort of not having confidence in the vaccines, well, those are conversations that we just still need to have to assure people that the vaccine is extremely safe and highly effective.
One survey I had seen suggested that some people, even when they see that the vaccines are free, their experience with the healthcare system has them worried that they'll find a way to be billed somehow. But the main message there is the vaccine is free. If somebody tries to bill you for it, they're doing it wrong, right?
That's right. Nobody should get a bill for the vaccine. And it's easy to conflate the system that's being used to vaccinate people with our healthcare system, where you can get an unexpected bill. And if you do, you should call your healthcare provider immediately, and they should retract that immediately.
Good news about the vaccines again. It seems like they are still working really well, even as we see news about new variants, which we're going to get into in a little bit. The vaccine effectiveness, Ajay, if I'm reading things right, still really quite good.
Yeah, against the worst outcomes of COVID, the vaccines remain effective, even against the new variants. There is that new Delta variant that has been detected in Wisconsin since April. We've had 26 cases. It hasn't taken off. It hasn't become the dominant strain yet, but there are states in the U.S. where the Delta variant does represent almost 20% of cases, and we don't want to get to that point, and that's something we need to be aware of.
With the variety of vaccination rates in the state, just looking at, you have some counties, Dane and Bayfield, over 60% vaccinated. You have some counties, Taylor and Clark, under 30% vaccinated. How much of a worry is it now if we get this Delta variant more widespread? It spreads, it seems like, faster and easier. How worried are we about it hitting pockets where there are lots of unvaccinated people?
Well, it's almost inevitable, just because the Delta variant is 60% more infectious than the Alpha variant, which is the dominant strain right now. And the Alpha variant was already 50% more infectious than the original strain that we had when this pandemic started. So we're talking about a virus that is highly infectious. It will make its way into those pockets where there are more unvaccinated people. And that's definitely a concern. It's unclear whether this particular variant will lead to sort of a higher rate of hospitalizations. There's some data around the world that suggests that could be the case, but there's nothing definitive. But it's something that we should be concerned about because there is evidence that this variant may escape some of the monoclonal treatments that are available for people with COVID.
Talking to Ajay Sethi, epidemiologist at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at some of the latest news on COVID-19, the latest variants, and what's going on with vaccination. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you see people in your community, your friend network, your family network, your workplace getting vaccinated? Are you in a community that has lower vaccination rates? What do you think would help get more people vaccinated? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Dan is with us in Monona. Dan, hello.
Hi, I just was going to tell you my story. I did the AstraZeneca study. So they pay $100 every time you go, which was a no-brainer for me. And so you get the, it's a double blind, so you don't know if you get it or whatever. And when I got the shot, I didn't think I got it at all. I didn't feel anything. I wasn't sick. I didn't even feel it going to my arm. And so then you go in, at first it's more frequently, like maybe it was a couple weeks and then a month, they get blood tests and they give you $100 for that. And, but then around in May came and they weren't going to approve it for the U.S. So I needed to figure out if I was vaccinated or not. So they broke the blind and, I was vaccinated.
Okay, because you didn't know until that point if you were in the placebo group or not, right?
Right, and I thought for sure I was because, like I said, I didn't get sick or anything. So I was like, oh, so I've been vaccinated since November. I'm like, bonus, and I got like $700 out of it.
All right. Dan, thank you a lot for sharing that story behind the scenes in testing one of these vaccines. And Ajay, the AstraZeneca vaccine, Dan has it. Most of us can't get it. This one never got approved in the U.S. It's being used elsewhere in the world. Why did this one not end up getting approved, at least not yet in the U.S.?
You know, by the time data were available for Moderna and Pfizer, you know, that ended up being the vaccines that were approved in the U.S. And the AstraZeneca vaccine was poised to be authorized at some point. But we now have three vaccines, as you know, if we add the Johnson & Johnson. So we don't have that sort of need for AstraZeneca at the moment. But it is used around the world. But the Pfizer and Moderna, and because supplies are good for those two, as well as Johnson & Johnson, we don't have a need right now for AstraZeneca. But thank you to Dan for volunteering for the clinical trial. We wouldn't have these vaccines if it weren't for volunteers to test whether or not these vaccines can be safe and effective.
Dan, thanks again for sharing that story. We'll go to Dennis now in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. My concern is we don't know yet whether we're going to need boosters for the current variants or new variants. So I just wonder, well, are they going to determine, hey, there's a new wave here, so we need to have this booster, or are they going to figure, hey, we need this booster to prevent a wave?
Interesting, Dennis. Thanks for the question, Ajay. Boosters for vaccines for potential future variants. What's the current thinking on that?
Yeah, so it's a combination of relying on data from lots of sources to make that decision that boosters are needed. So in the laboratory, there are researchers trying to determine whether the vaccines are effective against current variants. And then at a population level, using epidemiological data, when there's a surge in cases, we can then sample the virus from those cases to see if there's a new variant that's occurring and if they're occurring in people who are previously vaccinated. So it's a combination of all sorts of sort of magnifying glasses to use to figure out what may be causing a surge and whether or not our vaccines remain effective. There probably will be boosters sometime in the future. We just don't know when. And we'd like to avoid that by having more people choose vaccination.
Dennis, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Ajay Sethi, epidemiologist and professor of population health sciences at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at where things stand with COVID-19 cases and vaccinations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about the vaccines and what it'll take to comfortably put the pandemic behind us? Are you concerned about any of the variants we're seeing, what they could mean for unvaccinated people in particular? And what has changed in your daily life if you're vaccinated since you got vaccinated? Are you de-masking, for example, in more places than usual? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Ajay Sethi, epidemiologist and professor at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest COVID-19 news and vaccinations here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest or your experiences getting vaccinated or giving vaccinations yourself. And what was life like before and after being fully vaccinated? Were you quick to go back to old habits, or did it take a little getting used to? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to Richard now in Two Rivers. Richard, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Richard?
I'm kind of mad because I worked in the health field for many years, and I know the games they play, and if you want to get a shot, you can get it for free. But if you have insurance, they'll run it through there first. And I just want to know, what's that all about?
Richard, thanks a lot for the call. So, Ajay, I know a lot of healthcare providers will reach out to their patients and bring them in. I don't think they run any fees through insurance, or they shouldn't be, right?
Yeah, they shouldn't be. And I'm not a healthcare provider to understand the games that Richard is describing. But they shouldn't be. And you know, I think for the vaccine, there are funds set aside for all vaccinators to be able to vaccinate citizens in Wisconsin. Shouldn't be an issue.
And part of the reasoning for providing shots through healthcare providers, I imagine, is that they have contact with lots of people and know how to reach out to them. But that's not the only place. There are community sites, some at pharmacies. Is that part of the key to getting lots of people vaccinated, I guess, leaving no stone unturned?
Yeah, that's right. You definitely want to use sort of all strategies. And the more vaccinators, the better. People then can have options to decide what's most convenient for them. When it is a healthcare provider and connected to the healthcare system, you might be able to get some of your questions answered, which is helpful. A lot of people do go to their doctor when they do have questions about things like getting vaccinated.
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. We'll bring on Mary now, calling from Milwaukee. Mary, hello. Oop, are you there, Mary? Oh, it sounded like Mary was picking up her phone and disconnected. Maybe she'll call back. Try again at 800-642-1234, Mary. So let's talk about life post-vaccinated, Ajay. Can you talk about recommendations on things like social distancing, masking indoors, and so on after we're vaccinated?
Well, after vaccination, you really can return to pre-pandemic life. You're protected against the strains that are circulating. And really, we're just seeing that COVID is spreading pretty much exclusively in people who are unvaccinated. when you're vaccinated, you can be confident that you will not pick up the virus. And if you do, you're not going to be infectious and become a source of spread to others. So the mask can come off. I think if you're around people who want you to wear a mask, it's a good idea to keep one in your pocket. It's a respectful thing to do. And in some environments, like healthcare systems, you'll probably still need to wear a mask even though you're vaccinated. And the federal government tells us that when you're on public transportation, you should also be wearing a mask. But for other activities, they can come off. You can reduce the distance and just feel safer.
And that reminds me, I saw reporting, I think this was from NBC, where they're calling around to hospital emergency rooms around the country. And one, way fewer people are hospitalized now for COVID, in part because of the large part because of the vaccines. And two, the people who are in hospitals because of COVID, vast majority of them are unvaccinated people. That is our biggest risk right now, it sounds like, this group of unvaccinated people, Ajay.
Yeah, that's right. There was a study that came out a few weeks ago from the Cleveland Clinic Foundation, which showed that 99% of people who have been hospitalized for COVID were unvaccinated. And that's pretty compelling to me. If you get vaccinated, you can avoid the worst outcomes of COVID.
Talking to Ajay Sethi from the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's an epidemiologist. We're looking at the latest COVID-19 news and the latest updates on vaccination rates. Still time for your questions and experiences and thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ajay, we've heard some people talking about natural immunity. If you've had COVID, you've got some level of immunity. And, you know, how does that compare to vaccines and things like that? But a worry I've seen coming up in some reporting is that there are people who got sick at some point during COVID, assumed it was COVID, never got tested, and think they have natural immunity. That's not a safe bet, is it?
No, especially a year ago when influenza and COVID were circulating. And also, that's also a year ago. We don't know how long that natural immunity might last. It seems to be not as durable than the immunity you get from the vaccine. So it's a good idea to still get the vaccines. I don't want to dismiss the immunity that people might have from natural infection. It's just that we don't know how durable it is, and it can definitely vary. We've done studies in some of my research groups showing that the fewer symptoms you had, the fewer antibodies you produce. People with more severe disease probably have more immunity if they survived it. But at the end of the day, studies keep showing that if you get vaccinated, you get more durable, more reliable immunity.
Now, looking at the age of people getting vaccinated in Wisconsin, some of the good vaccination news, older people, the most vulnerable, we're looking at like an 80% vaccination rate. I think that's 65 and up. Want to look at the opposite end of the age spectrum now, or almost opposite. We've got 12 to 15-year-olds getting vaccinated in the state now. They're the newest eligible group. Just getting rolling there, I think about 1 in 8 or so vaccinated so far. How important is it for people to get those kids vaccinated, even though they may not be as high a risk if they do get COVID?
Yeah, so they don't represent most of the hospitalizations that have occurred for COVID, but there's a lot unknown about this virus, and we know that there can be lingering symptoms even in younger people. And it's just probably better and safer for everybody, really, to get vaccinated, especially children, where we just don't have a lot of data on what this virus can do long term. And kudos to really all children under 18 who have gotten vaccinated. They may not fully understand the importance of their decision. So it's just great to sort of see that they're interested and willing to contribute sort of to the greater good of cutting down on transmission. We also are just concerned about these new variants. And if we have a lot of younger individuals and children unvaccinated, those new variants are going to make their way into kids. And we really don't know much at all about how those new variants will behave. So choosing vaccination is a good idea. And I hope parents are continuing to have these conversations with their kids.
And Ajay, we focus mostly on Wisconsin and here in the U.S. mostly good trends here. That's not necessarily true around the world. India recently had kind of a nightmare hotspot scenario. Where are you watching around the world as we have this race to get vaccines to countries that haven't had much of them so far?
Yeah, I mean, every place, as soon as you take your eye off of a given region or country, you return to that place later. So in the UK, for example, they are very concerned about this new Delta variant sort of supplanting the Alpha variant that they've already had. And it's happening rather rapidly, and it's a concern. India remains a place of concern, and there are areas in South America as well. But here in Wisconsin, I definitely keep my eyes on the data to see if there's any upticks, especially in those communities with low vaccination rates. And hopefully that can improve, especially since now is the time for people to get vaccinated, given there's these much more highly infectious variants that are starting to spread in the country.
We saw a dip in numbers back early last summer, only to come back in the fall. Are you worried about areas with lower vaccine rates as we get back into fall, back to school, indoor season?
Yeah, definitely. We do not have really any county in the state that is in that really high range of vaccination. I mean, Dane County is doing very well, especially among 65 years older and older than that. But, you know, there are still pockets of people, you know, who are not vaccinated. And there's always a concern as soon as they gather, if somebody has the virus, particularly one of these infectious variants, it will take off at that gathering.
Ajay, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you, Rob.
Ajay Sethi is an associate professor of population health sciences and director of the Master of Public Health program at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He talked with us today about the latest COVID-19 news, including the state's decision to wind down hours at 6 community vaccination clinics and the latest vaccination trends. Now, an endangered species of bird may have a chance at making a comeback this year because of lower lake levels. The piping plover is a small bird that likes to hang out by lake shores. Rising lake levels in recent years have destroyed habitat for the birds, but this year they may catch a break. Eric Andrews is an ornithology specialist for the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa Tribe's Natural Resources Department. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, Eric, can you describe the piping plover? What do they look like and where can we find them?
The piping plover is a shorebird. It's only about 6 inches in length. It's light gray on top with white on the bottom with a collar of black and a small bridge of black between the eyes. You'll see them most often on undisturbed beaches walking along the tide line.
And we've had high lake levels in Wisconsin and the area, I understand, for some years. Can you talk about the problem that's been for the piping plovers?
Yes. So piping plovers really like beaches that are a nice wide space of sand between, you know, the tide and the dunes. They like it when it's an undeveloped area with very little disturbance and little human traffic. And so in recent years with higher lake levels, we've seen those beaches more or less underwater. And when these spots that are available can be threatened by storm water surges and other disturbance. So it's been much harder for them to nest successfully.
As I understand it, Eric, piping plovers are listed as threatened nationwide, endangered in the Great Lakes area. I imagine that's got to be more than just lake levels that's putting them at risk.
That's correct. The piping plover has been listed as endangered since the Endangered Species Act has been in effect. They suffered species decline early on in the 1900s when they were overhunted for use as part of fashion. And then later with shoreline development and more people visiting beaches, saw their nesting areas more and more disturbed, and their nesting habitat was shrunk. With the entire nation, there's three separate breeding populations. There's the Great Plains population, there's the Northern Atlantic population, and then there's the Great Lakes population. The other two populations are listed as threatened, whereas the Great Lakes population is endangered. Starting in 1984, when the Endangered Species Act went into effect, we only had 17 breeding pairs in the entire Great Lakes region.
Wow. How are we doing now?
Well, we hit a record high of around 70 breeding pairs in around 2017. So we've definitely come up a good way since the 1980s. Still have a ways to go, but we've at least through our efforts of monitoring and protection have been able to bring those numbers up and help stabilize the population within the Great Lakes. But 70 is still not a very large number of breeding pairs, and it's still a very precarious position. Most of the breeding pairs in the Great Lakes are in Michigan at Sleeping Bear Dunes, but here in Wisconsin we have two breeding locations, one down in Green Bay on Cat Island, and then the other up here in the Shawamigan Bay and the Apostle Islands.
Well, here we are with lower lake levels now. What are the hopes for 2021 for those breeding pairs?
We're hoping to see as many chicks as possible. We currently have two breeding pairs on Long Island up here in the Shawamigan Bay. We have another two pairs on Outer Island. And hopefully we're going to see each season, each breeding pair can raise up to four chicks. And hopefully we're going to see as many as possible chicks reach the end of the season and fledge to migrate south for the winter.
Now, I imagine our restoration effort isn't just hope for local lower lake levels. What kind of habitat protections are out there now?
So we, on any beach that we know there's visitors and we have access to, we like to station monitors out there to, one, we put together what we call exclosures. They are small cages that we put over the nest that the bird can pass into without issue, but keeps predators such as coyotes, raccoons, crows, merlins, great horned owls. It keeps them from getting to the nest and taking those eggs away. We also have monitors erect what we call psychological fencing. It is basically rope to denote that a certain area is protected as a nesting site so that visitors to the beach can know that this is a protected area and to stay as far away from the nest as possible, especially when walking dogs and traversing the beach, because half of our work is, you know, working with the birds, but the other half is, you know, working with visitors to these beaches and, you know, doing outreach and education so people can be as invested in the species survival as we are.
And so, yeah, people might hear about this fairly rare bird, want to go out and see it. It sounds like we should give it as much room as we can. Do I have that right?
That is correct. They are very sensitive to disturbance, and these nests, they are basically a small little bowl in the sand on the beach. There's no big, like, you know, sticks and thing that say this is a nest. You can walk right over a nest without ever seeing it there. And especially because they like to lay their eggs in broad swaths of cobble and stone, and the eggs look just like stones. And so it's very easy for people to be in a nesting location without ever knowing it.
Eric, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
That's Eric Andrews, ornithology specialist for the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Tribe's Natural Resources Department, telling us about the threatened, actually in the Great Lakes area, endangered bird species, the piping plover. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with more on a fading business with a loyal customer base.
Browsing video stores for the perfect rental has long been replaced with the ease of scrolling online streaming services from home. But there's still a group of Wisconsinites who prefer nostalgia to convenience. Andy Turner has more.
The video stores that once brought a slice of Hollywood to town are now empty buildings that might house vaping shops or check cashing stores. In January, Family Video, which outlasted similar national chains like Blockbuster and Hollywood Video by a decade, announced it was closing its remaining 250 stores, including 23 in Wisconsin. But some video stores have held on. Four Star Video Cooperative has operated in Madison since 1985 and has found a niche with people who do not want to be entertained on streaming alone. Louis Peterson is Four Star's owner. He says customers enjoy browsing, plus there's a far greater variety than streaming channels, and a better sense of permanence that you don't always find in ever-changing streaming lineups controlled by large media companies like Disney and Netflix.
There is definitely always will be a place for physical media, just as something that is an unchanging record of film history and allowing people to have access to that.
Four Star customer Evelyn Kale says she first went to Four Star in 2004 when she visited her older sister in Madison and they rented the Johnny Depp thriller Secret Window. She encountered Four Star again about a decade later when she was in nursing school and noticed Four Star offered a flat rate subscription plan.
And I just saw it on a sandwich board. And I was like, you know, that's a pretty good deal. I don't pay for internet and they have a wide movie selection and I've been going ever since then.
Kale became a volunteer in 2019, around the time the store's four-person cooperative ownership fell apart and before Peterson was ultimately able to find a new partner. She says she saw Peterson put his heart and soul into the business.
From the other patrons at the video store, like obviously, like no one wanted to see it go. So I think, you know, a lot of people just came together and said, what can we do to help?
Beyond providing entertainment, Four Star is a resource in other ways for the Madison community. Craig Warner taught Afro-American studies and integrated liberal studies at UW-Madison for 35 years before retiring 2 years ago. He says he frequently showed movies in his classes and with small groups of students. He relied heavily on Four Star over the years. He also praises Four Star's contribution to film culture in Madison.
I like the culture. I like the sense of belonging to a place where film matters to people, and it still does in Madison.
Brian Alberth wants to pay tribute to stores like Four Star. Alberth is making a documentary about the store and other niche video stores in cities like Austin, Seattle, and Philadelphia. The idea for the documentary was sparked by Albert's frustration that he had stopped visiting Four Star, or any video store for that matter.
The video store was a necessary place to find wherever I lived. You know, just like your local grocery store, gas stations, it also had to be the video store and the movie theater.
Growing up in Racine, Albert loved looking at VHS and DVD covers and browsing the aisles of video stores.
You know, I think other people hold on to football games or to old cars and 8-tracks or whatever it is. You know, maybe it's vinyl. But people hold on to things because it brings back a sense of nostalgia, a sense of, you know, some element of growing up that they don't want to lose.
Video stores might be outmatched by streaming's convenience and further pummeled by the pandemic, but they live on thanks to passionate fans who prefer community to ease.
Andy Turner is a freelance journalist, college English instructor, and radio DJ who lives in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin farmers and manufacturers have been able to try their luck in the hemp market since it came back to Wisconsin in 2018. But according to the State Department of Agriculture, processor applications are down 37% compared to last year, and hemp grower applications are down 48%. Our guest is here to share how the industry has been doing over the last few years and what would need to happen to ensure Wisconsin hemp is successful. Philip Scott is president and founder of the Wisconsin Hemp Farmers and Manufacturers Association. Philip, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yes, thank you for having me, Rob.
We have these declines in numbers for applications both to grow for the hemp market and to process it. So what do we know about what's causing that decline?
Well, across the industry, it's been a very competitive atmosphere, as well as a lot of individuals had a lot of hope to make a lot of money in the beginning of this and get ahead of everybody. And unfortunately, the regulation kind of slowed down the growth and the thinking on all of that. So,
and I understand that federal regulations have been kind of a moving target. What kind of changes have we seen?
Well, we've gone from 2014 doing research to the U.S. Farm Bill to allowing everybody in the country and the states, the 50 states and territories, to develop a state program and then move forward. A lot of states this year are following a USDA program. The legislation then moved again to allow us to follow under pilot research again. So, you know, in Wisconsin, we're getting excited, hopefully, for some final ruling going to the USDA and giving us a permanent program so we all kind of know where we sit.
I want to talk about what the market for hemp is. And as I understand it, there's CBD oil and then there's everything else. Let's take those one at a time. First of all, CBD oil, how important is that for the people trying to money make growing and processing hemp?
Well, it's very important. You know, I believe our statistics show 75 to 85% of all the hemp grown in Wisconsin up to this point, at least the data that we track here at WIFMA, has shown that it is CBD grown. So there is a major market there that farmers are chasing after. And the thing with that is it's become very competitive, but, you know, the ones that are sticking it out for the long term are figuring out ways to diversify and stay in that game.
And I've heard past guests have told me growing for CBD is more like horticulture than agriculture. I don't know exactly what that means, but I get the gist, I think. Does it require a different level of care when you're growing for the CBD market?
So it does. So originally in our state, most people figured it would be 14 to 24,000 an acre roughly to actually plant, procure, and get that final product so you can bring it to market. And most of our farmers have adapted now and realized that we don't need to spend all this major money in a lot of infrastructure to make that happen. You know, this year, my target on per acre would be about $4,500 per acre, the way the market has fluctuated, so everybody can stay profitable.
Talking to Philip Scott. Go ahead.
It is a more hands-on plant. And when I tell a lot of people that ask me, they go, "Hey, Phil, you know, I want to get into this hemp thing." I say, "Hey, there's a lot of old Wisconsin tobacco farmers in our state." And I say, "Hey, you might want to find one of them and ask them how hard it was with tobacco and see the infrastructure they had in place, because a lot of it does follow that same type of infrastructure needed to make it successful."
Talking to Philip Scott, president and founder of the Wisconsin Hemp Farmers and Manufacturers Association, getting an update on the hemp industry. A lot of people were excited when it came back to Wisconsin. Some people getting out of the market, applications for farming it this year and processing it down compared to last year. Now, Phil, back in the day, we in Wisconsin, a lot of other places, grew hemp for not CBD oil, but for its use as a fiber product. Has a market for those hemp products come back in a significant enough amount to make that potentially profitable?
Up till the beginning of this year, I would say it was starting to, but the beginning of 2020 to the beginning of 2021, you started to see a huge market shift in people wanting to research. You know, at the U.S. level, you have the U.S. Hemp Feed Coalition that has been working behind the scenes and in front of the media to be able to open up the idea that we can use the hemp grain for cattle feed. We can use it for animal feed. We can start to use the hemp stalks for animal bedding. You know, we can go as deep as hemp concrete. You know, one of the biggest things that happened, I think a lot of people at first started to approach a lot of legislatures around the country and say, we want to replace. But when you look at, you know, how long communities have been around and the economics that involved with them, we don't want to replace. We need to find that niche, that 15 to 20% of the market, and go from there.
One thing that's unique for somebody growing hemp in Wisconsin is with any other crop, they don't have to worry about THC levels. If the wrong strain gets mixed in or something like that, all of a sudden they're maybe getting a visit from the DEA. How tough is this for farmers to watch out for this?
Well, the lucky thing for Wisconsin is we're under pilot this year. So there's kind of a lead wave from 0.3 to 1%. And they're allowed now at the federal level a little bit of remediation if the state's willing to follow it from 0.3 to 1. So, you know, I typically tell my farmers, if, as long as you do your research on genetics, you should be safe. You know, year one and year two of the program, we did have a few strains and a few farmers that got the wrong strains and unfortunately tested out and had to destroy all their hard work. So we've come a long way, and, you know, people are doing their homework before they buy genetics. Genetics have went from $1 to $3 a seedling down to 75 cents, depending on where you're purchasing them from.
On the financial side of things, Phil, what are things like for getting financing from a bank or getting crop insurance, that kind of thing? Are these markets proven enough to where you can go and get those things?
Well, you know, on our end, it's been tough. You know, luckily we do have a bank account open in the state of Wisconsin. We're very fortunate here. A lot of hemp farmers across the country have had bank accounts shut even to this day. On our end, financing as a farmer has been tough, but the producers and processors in our state have been able to at least, there's a few banks in our state that have opened up and allowed them to get financing for equipment.
I know, Phil, when hemp was first coming back to Wisconsin, I think a lot of people were pretty excited about the economic potential. Seems like people are a little nervous about it right now. Long term, what do you think the prospects are for hemp to be, you know, a decent share of Wisconsin's agricultural output?
I do think as those grain and fiber markets steadily open up, and then you look at the federal level with legislation kind of taking its time to curtain tail, when you follow everything involved with it, I do think that Wisconsin still could be one of the number one producers in the country. One, we have the water supply, and that seems to be one of the major issues in the country right now. We have the beautiful soil. We have the number two organic landmass in the whole country behind California. So as long as we are able to keep following how the industry goes, stay flexible as hemp farmers, and be able to be ready for that shift, I do think there is a very strong, and I've said it since day one, 25 to 30 year economic growth, and then building off of that maybe further, but I don't like to look too far ahead.
And Phil, in our last few moments, if there's a farmer listening who's been sitting on the sidelines thinking maybe next year I'll, you know, not convert my whole operation to hemp, but I'm thinking of dipping my toes in the market, what suggestions do you have for them?
My thing would say, get on the phones, call your U.S. congressmen, call your U.S. senators, and make sure they're on board with H.R. 841. That's Hemp Access and Consumer Safety Act. It's critical to protecting consumer safety and treating hemp producers fairly, as well as making hemp derivatives. That means that when we take the hemp and extract it, it allows us to be classified as a dietary supplement, and that'll allow us to start open up with the big manufacturers and the big food producers. So until that kind of happens, we're all sitting here hoping across the whole industry that this will happen at the federal level and the legislation will move forward and allow all of us to, you know, find those new markets that have not been tapped. Right now, there's only so many products we can make. I think I have 40 products myself. You know, at that point, we want to add more SKUs, add more products across the state, you know, as producers and bring better quality products to market, as well as bring that significant testing so then the consumer knows it's a safe product.
Phil, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for your time.
Philip Scott is president and founder of the Wisconsin Hemp Farmers and Manufacturers Association. We talked to him today about how Wisconsin hemp growers and processors are doing after a year-to-year dip in the number of people filing applications to grow and process hemp.